to Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains. I'm Corby Skinner.
And I'm Anna Page. And we're sharing stories of creative people who live and work in the Intermountain West.
Many of you know Ed Kemick as a newspaper reporter and editor in Montana for more than 35 years. He worked with the Billings Gazette until 2013 and then started his own online newspaper, The Last Best News, which shut down in 2018, much to the chagrin of many of its readers. He continues to work, though, as a freelance editor and writer and has published two books, the most recent, Montana, The Lay of the Land, The Best of Last Best News.
And I'd like to also welcome Alexis Bonagofsky to the studio. She's a fourth-generation Montanan, a goat and a sheep rancher, and a freelance writer and photographer who lives and works along the Yellowstone River in southeastern Montana. Her writing and photography can be found on her website, East of Billings, and as well she's worked for various news outlets and magazines, including Mountain Journal, Montana Quarterly, Truth Out, BuzzFeed, Farm Furrow 6, High Desert Journal, and also has an essay in the new book, A Million Acres, Montana Writers Reflect on Open Space. Welcome to the studio, Ed, Alexis.
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And Alexis, you also have an essay in Ed's new book, is that right?
I do. I do have an essay in two books somehow this year. So
congratulations.
Thank you.
You've been very busy. And you keep a lot of your writing in the public's eye through your own website, East of Billings. Maybe most recently people might remember the call out that you did to the Chamber of Commerce for some of their billboard material. That was well read and also, it seems like, received well. Did you expect that kind of attention?
I never know how those pieces are going to land, but I did expect a reaction. I was shocked that it had been in the public's eye for so long and no one else had written about it. And I had noticed it months before and I just hadn't had time to write about it. And so I was very surprised, actually, after I hit the publish button that 3 hours later the Chamber was emailing me.
And for those who might have not read or followed along, that was a campaign that had been up in the public eye for about 6 months, talking about Onward Pioneers, and some of their materials on their website as well were historically really inaccurate and really insensitive.
Completely. I mean, it was basically the language used was the same language used during the expansion westward and the genocide of Native Americans. And Onward Pioneers, today is ours for the taking, tomorrow too. And I just thought it was completely tone deaf and offensive to people.
I was coming back and I remember, I think outside of Gary Owen, seeing this Onward Pioneer billboard that was just shocking to me. I stopped at the chamber office, the tourism office, and picked up this beautiful, beautiful color brochure. And I'm not sure, but I thought manifest was even in it somewhere. I mean, there was terminology that just was so incredibly insensitive. I, you know, applaud you for really calling attention to something that I think the chamber had good intention, but obviously it hadn't been vetted by interested parties in our community.
Well, I think it's an example, too, of how information is trading online now. It looks very different. I mean, you are able to have a platform and a publish button and a voice that can be very well heard. And Ed, I think that you might have experienced this, too, all these years in the newspaper business. When did you start working in the journalism industry?
Way back in 1979.
Yeah, so they weren't really using online publishing tools at that point,
No, they were not.
And then leaving the newspaper business in 2013, you found an opportunity to create a newspaper online. And I'd imagine that there were a lot of struggles to be a one-man show and produce a newsworthy product. What was that like after leaving the Gazette?
Well, it was really hard. First of all, I didn't sleep for about 9 months as I was kind of planning the thing. And then just when I started, you know, just having to do everything myself, I'd always written stories and edited stories and I'd written headlines, but now I was selling ads and laying the thing out and doing the books and all those things you have to do when you run a business. So yeah, it was really hard, but it was also really, really fun, which is why I did it and why I kept going.
Alexis, how did you go about finding your audience for your blog site?
Well, initially the blog started because I felt that Eastern Montana's energy issues weren't being covered by the media in the way that I felt it should have been. And so I thought, you know, I had never written before besides, you know, in school and my papers. And I was like, well, if no one else is going to write about this, I'm going to write about it. So I started the blog East of Billings. I picked up a camera 5 years ago. I had never taken a class on photography. And so I thought I need to bring attention to Eastern Montana. So that's how it started. Initially, my audience was just Eastern Montanans. And then it grew and grew in a way that I never expected it to. And sometimes I look at it now, I write about a lot of different things on the blog, but I look at it as a way to write about things that I feel need to be illuminated, stories that aren't being written about.
How do you go about deciding what makes a story?
Well, and there again, that's one reason I had so much fun leaving traditional journalism, because I did want to do things that were a little bit off base, or whatever you want to call it, for, you know, traditional newspaper. And so when I went off on my own, I could literally write about anything I wanted. And that's also why I think it might be strange to have a book that's the best of a newspaper, because generally the news is the last thing you want to read in book form, because it all happened once and nobody cares about it. But in Last Best News, I had a lot of people write essays about life in Montana, what it meant to them. Like Alexis was one of the many people who wrote an essay for our Lay of the Land series, which is what I ended up using for the title of the book. And just a lot of fun stories that weren't really classifiable as news by any means, but were just more magazine pieces and fun looks at slice of life. And like I did a series of visits to 25 different churches in town and wrote a weekly review of those. I mean, that's not something you'd probably sell on most newspapers, but it's something I wanted to do for years and didn't think I would ever do it until I had Last Best News.
It's nice to have that freedom. And I think you do see journalism and modern storytelling evolving. I mean, people are interested in those stories, and they do trend really well. And it's not always just the what we call maybe digital rubbernecking that catches mm-hmm. the eye. So it's nice to get a place to stretch out a little bit. Why land? It seems like your work recently, both of you, has really been focused in on land. And Ed, how did you maybe bring these essays or, you know, work from Last Best News into this theme, Montana, the lay of the land?
Well, in this case, it wasn't really, I mean, it's just the old expression, lay of the land, where, you know, you get information that helps you understand a place or a situation. That's what I was thinking when I had that title, because they cover the full range of experiences. Some did have to do with the land, some had to do with relationships, some had to do with just people coming here and discovering a new way of life, and so on and so forth. Alexis was about the attempt to bring people together by all focusing on something we can all agree on, our love for dogs. I mean, it was a wonderful essay. So.
Alexis, you write about a lot of personal things in your life, and it's received in a way that I think is incredibly powerful for the reader, at least speaking from my perspective. But I imagine it's very gut-wrenching to put out your personal story in the ways that you have. For instance, you talk a lot about suicide in rural communities because your life was directly impacted mm-hmm. by your father's suicide. Have you found that writing and giving that a voice has been healing? And what reception have you received?
Yeah, for me, it's necessary to write about it. And one of my good friends, Joe Wilkins, who has been on your show before, has really helped me figure out how to write about it in a way that that can reach people. Because I think, you know, suicide is such a big issue in Montana, but it's not really talked about. And my family decided that we weren't going to hide it. And so for me to write about it is a way to let other people know that it's okay to talk about, and it's not something to be ashamed of.
I teach a public speaking class, and came across some statistics for students that I thought was interesting, that Montana has the highest percentage of people graduating from high school of 50 states, and we also have the highest suicide rate. Mm-hmm. We only have 7.3 people per square mile, and east of Billings, even less. Mm-hmm. So I think those sort of stories resonate, you know, and they're important to tell.
I think so, and I do think that, you know, there's a lot of addiction in Montana as well, which is part of my father's story, and it's one of those things that I just think if we can talk about a little bit more and we can talk about why this is an issue and bring it out into the open. Another thing Joe and I talked about a lot was that we do have these moments in our life that end up defining who we are. And I asked him one time, I said, I feel like all I'm writing about is my father's suicide. And he said, Alexis, he's like, for me, it was my father's death at the age of 9. And we come back to that. And that's kind of a defining moment. And that's okay. So I have spent a lot of time writing about it and exploring that. And the reception has been amazing. It's people really appreciate it, and I appreciate the fact that I'm able to do it, and people hopefully can feel like they're not alone.
Ed, you recently sold Last Best News, and will we see a resurgence of that website in some form and some new stories coming out into the community?
Yeah, I sold it late last year to two Great Falls natives, one of whom lives in Billings, one of whom is in Washington, D.C., and their hope is to revive it sometime in 2020. I just had a conversation with one of them this week, and we agreed that the sooner the better with the election coming up, and so they're trying, they've interviewed a lot of people around the country already to find a person to take it over. But yeah, they do intend to revive it and, you know, make some changes, but basically keep it going much as it was before. So I'm excited, and I'll be sticking around as a contributing writer too and helping them get going once they hire somebody.
It might be a little relieving for you to just be a contributing editor instead of, you know, the bookkeeper, the custodian, the jack.
Yeah,
of
just
all
write
trades.
Whatever I want when I want and turn down those things I don't want.
I just saw today that the fourth version of Call of the Wild has been made into a movie with Harrison Ford and a character-generated dog, which kind of disappointed me. But I kept thinking, why Call of the Wild? I mean, are there stories that relate to people, to land, to animals, that are powerful enough to continue retelling?
That was a really important story in a lot of childhood narratives, I think, and so maybe it's just coming back to it. But I have a sidebar. Call of the Wild, indulge me. I got a call today from a reader who wanted to know the movie times for Call of the Wild, and I told her I didn't have them. The theaters no longer provide that information to the paper, and the paper no longer prints it. She doesn't use the internet, and she called the movie theater, and she got a recording that said she had to buy tickets online. And I thought,
wow,
how fast our information delivery system has changed, and how many people are being left behind in those shifting models. And it is something that is really hard to discuss with the decline of the print business. And it's a multifaceted problem. But I think we're seeing spring-ups of information here and there. And it just got me really thinking, I really hope there's more people out there willing to pick up these torches.
And could I just say that if she doesn't use the internet, she's not going to like the animatronic dog. I've seen the trailers. It's pretty disappointing.
My dog Rolo looks exactly like that dog. I was like, they could have used him in that movie.
Yeah, they could have used a lot of real dogs.
But isn't it interesting, even though we have this automated, computer-generated news information, but people are still selling books. I mean, the number of books that were sold last year was a record number. Mm-hmm. Both of you are writers, publishers. What do you think that's all about?
I mean, I think what books give us is something real. And I think people want to connect to that. I spend time on the internet when I need to, but I still love books, and And I don't know anyone in my life really that has moved away from that. So I don't know. I don't know if I have a good answer to that.
Well, I give that some thought, of course, because of my interests and what I do for a living and everything else. But I think people are making a conscious decision to read books. Maybe there was this move away from it for a while among some people, and they're coming back because they realize how crazy and somewhat dangerous it is to be getting all your information from a handheld device. You know, I can't remember who it was and where I even saw this, probably on my handheld device, but this woman was talking about how the internet and all the social media are so new that all these problems we're having are kind of like childhood diseases that none of us have immune systems built up to yet. And so we're just dealing with all these things that nobody knows how to deal with. And I think a lot of people, obviously we're not going to become disconnected from the web and from social media, but we do want to break away more. And one of the best ways to do it is to sit down with a book in a quiet room and read the dang thing. I mean, it's such a different experience mm-hmm. from interacting with your phone.
Well, speaking of your books, I know that you both brought copies of some of your latest work. Would you care to share? Ed, can we start with you? Do you have something that you'd like to share and set up for us?
Well, I was trying to think of what might be a good short thing, and I won't read the whole piece, but I wrote kind of what we call in the business a news obituary, and I've always loved writing these, oddly enough, just because they're just a perfect time to remind people of some of the good people among us and what their lives meant. And, you know, I think it's just one of the most useful things we can do is to remind people that virtue is its own reward and that when you die, people will love you for what you've done if you've done the right thing. And so I wrote about Vince Larson. I'll just read part of it here. And this, let's see, I think it ran March 29th, 2017. So here's the beginning. It's just called Vince Larson, Citizen. Two things surprised me about Vince Larson's obituary, which appeared in the Billings Gazette on March 27th, 2017. The first surprise was his age. I don't know that I ever thought how old he was, but 87? Vince had the energy and the intellectual curiosity of someone half that age, and he had a way of transmitting his enthusiasm for life to everyone around him. The second surprise was that the obituary made no mention of the Four Dances Natural Area, the spectacular 765-acre property atop the rims across the river from Colson Park that Vince and his wife, Louise, put under a conservation easement and then sold to the Bureau of Land Management almost 20 years ago at about half its appraised value. It's there for all of us in perpetuity, a unique slice of Montana, and probably Vince's most important legacy for people in this part of the world. That's how I met Vince, writing about Four Dances in 1998 when the transfer to the BLM was almost complete, and I crossed paths with him many times over the years. He always had something interesting to say, usually about current events, but the subject hardly mattered. What mattered was that Vince was unfailingly passionate about whatever was on his mind. And he never failed to ask me about my youngest daughter, Perry. Years ago, as he had with so many young people, he had taken Perry under his wing. I asked her for her thoughts today, and she wrote, "Vince made me think about the world in ways I had never had before. He and Louise were introduced to me through my friend, Kia Abbey. We were both so lucky as young women to have two passionate, intelligent, and kind older people in our lives who genuinely believed in our potential as strong female forces for good in the world. Vince knew so much about the world in both its joys and its injustices, and he aimed to make them right." At his funeral service at First Presbyterian Church in Billings, the Reverend Dave Thompson read some of the responses he got when he asked family members and friends of Vince what one word they would use to describe him. Those responses included generous, caring, quiet, humble, kind, faithful, steady, wise, loyal, and remarkable. Sounds like Vince to me. Thompson also mentioned something else that was perfectly Vince-like. One of the songs Vince chose for his funeral, which he'd planned out in some detail starting 3 months ago, knowing that his cancer was getting worse, was Amazing Grace. That's hardly an unusual choice for a funeral service, but Thompson said Vince liked it as much for its backstory as its music and lyrics. The composer, John Newton, was an Englishman who'd captained slave ships before undergoing a conversion experience, after which he became an Anglican minister and a prominent supporter of the abolition of slavery. Also at the funeral, Jim Duncan said that Vince was a quiet, steady supporter of Yes for Kids, which Duncan co-chaired and which was formed to round up financial support for School District 2. Suddenly, it made more sense that Vince's obituary didn't mention four dances, because it didn't mention any of his philanthropic activities. It was something he probably insisted on. His humility was as genuine as it was thoroughgoing. Jim Gransberry, a former Gazette reporter who knew Vince well, might have put it best when he said that Vince, quote, devoted his whole life to being a good citizen. That was just right, with its emphasis not only on being good, but being good in a way that made the world better, that improved society. Vince did have some strong opinions. Thompson said that when he became minister at First Presbyterian, the first question Vince asked him was his take on the Palestinian-Israeli situation. Vince believed that this country's virtually unconditional support of Israel was tragically harmful to the Mideast and eroded our own democratic values. My own beliefs, such as they were, didn't go that far, but I never felt prepared to take on his passion and his deeply informed arguments. His obituary, probably wisely, didn't mention Israel either. Significantly, what it did mention, and in great detail, was how growing up white on the campus of an all-black college in Mississippi, where his father was the first full-time professor, was an experience that shaped the rest of his life, that made him eager to engage people of different nationalities, races, and religions. That was more important in Vince's mind than talking about the good deeds he had done and the worthwhile causes he supported. And he couldn't resist using the platform of his obituary to leave people with one last beautiful piece of advice. Walk outside in the dark of the night and look up at the sky, he wrote. Note the countless stars and realize how fortunate you really are to be alive in such a vast universe. Do something about the world we live in. Give thanks and appreciate the gift of life that has been given to you. Do something for others every day and show your gratitude. Work for peace. It is so simple. Just be kind and respectful of others. Thompson read that paragraph during the service on Wednesday and said, there's your homework, right from Vince. Vince was an eager student of the world for all of his long life and a great teacher until the very end.
I love news obituaries for the ways that you get to enter into somebody's life that are so expanded beyond what you read from the funeral home or the family. Thanks for sharing that, Ed.
Thank you.
Are probably the toughest form of journalism that I've experienced. Alexis, what have you brought to share with us today? I'd love to hear some of your writing as well.
Sure. So I'm going to give a little backstory to this book. It's called A Million Acres, Montana Writers Reflect on Open Space. And it was put out by the Montana Land Reliance, which helps protect agricultural land in Montana through conservation easements. And a bunch of the writers who are part of this book have probably been on your show already. And so it's a compilation of amazing essays, short stories, fiction, nonfiction, memoir. And Joe Wilkins is the first essay. And it also has photographs by myself that go along with each of the essays. And so I wrote an essay for this book, and it's called In This Place. And each vignette is framed by a GPS coordinate, because for me, I think very geographically, I can't, you know, my whole life I've spent in Montana, and I can't really separate myself from the land. And I think one of the things most of these writers portray is that Montana is a character in their stories and is the muse behind what they write. And so, you know, you can't separate what we're writing from the place that we're in. So I'm just going to pick one of these vignettes and read it to you. I walk out my back door through the yard into the north pasture all the way to the first slough and keep going until I end up in our dog graveyard. I never call it that, but that's what it is. When someone asks, I say it's the place we bury our dogs. That sounds less morbid. When I go there, I remember two moments. I see my dad dressed in an old Big Sky State Games t-shirt, Wrangler jeans, tennis shoes, a ball cap, and his aviator sunglasses. He is digging a deep hole into the ground under a small hill. Next to him, wrapped in a blanket, is Max, his German wire-haired pointer. Max the Great. Max, there has never been another dog like him. Max, the dog who would retrieve any bird no matter what. Max, who went to the work at the tire store with my dad every day and had his own doggy door so he could move freely in and out of the shop. That Max. He is black and white, and he has a beautiful beard, and he is dead. I am standing next to the skid steer that holds a bucket of rocks from the Yellowstone River that I brought up to cover his grave. I watch as my father picks Max up and gently lays him in the ground. I stay quiet as he grabs the shovel to fill the hole. Everyone who knows the first shovel of dirt is the hardest. You are wondering what the second moment is. It is a Saturday morning in late September. I sit on my four-wheeler in the clearing. On the back of the four-wheeler is my cat, Dustin. He is in a box. He will be the first cat to be buried in the place where we bury our dogs. A worthy honor for a cat who most likely thought he was a dog. My dad calls my cell phone. We start talking about smoking meat. He has a custom smoker built out of a stainless steel cooler he bought at an auction when a restaurant closed in Billings. I am using it today to smoke beef brisket for a friend's wedding, and I ask him to come down to the farm and help me. "You don't need me, honey. You can do it yourself," he says. I bury Dustin next to Max. The next day, my dad dies. "You don't need me, honey. You can do it yourself." I leave those words in the clearing on my farm. They stay there. If I want to remember them, I take a short walk. In this place, I learn that the land holds memories for us when they are too hard to carry by ourselves.
Well, we're all in tears right now. Wow, what a gift to hear both of your voices, learn more about your path, and I hope that any way that you can, that you continue sharing your words with the world. Thank you, Ed Kimmick, Alexis Bonagofsky. Thank you for being here with us today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
Resounds, Arts and Culture on the High Plains is produced by Corby Skinner, Anna Page, and Ken Siebert for Yellowstone Public Radio. Theme music by Alex Naumann. Additional funding provided by the Greater Montana Foundation, encouraging communication on issues, trends, and values of importance to Montanans. More information on Resounds is available at ypradio.org.